This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Don Roos, wrote and directed the film comedy The Opposite of Sex. Time magazine film critic Richard Corliss described it as the smartest, edgiest, most human, and handsomely acted romantic comedy in years. The Opposite of Sex is Roos's directing debut. He also wrote the screenplays for Love Field, Single White Female, and Boys on the Side. The Opposite of Sex stars Christina Ricci as a 16-year-old who runs away from home with her boyfriend, dumps him, goes to mooch off her half-brother, then turns his life upside down, starting with seducing his boyfriend. The ensemble cast includes Lisa Kudrow, Martin Donovan, Lyle Lovett, and Johnny Galecki. This is a social satire with a big heart, even though the Christina Ricci character, who narrates the story, is self-centered, cravenly manipulative, and cruel. To give you a sense of her, here's her opening narration.
If you're one of those people who don't like movies where some person you can't see talks the whole time and covers up all the holes in the plot, and at the end says, "I was never the same again after that summer," or whatever, like it was so deep they can't stand it, then you're out of luck. Things get very complicated here very quick, and my guess is you're not going to be up to it without me talking.
Lord, help me.
If you think I'm just plucky and scrappy and all I need is love, you're in over your head. I don't have a heart of gold, and I don't grow one later, okay? But relax. There's other people a lot nicer coming up. We call them losers.
Don Roos, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Tell me why you wanted to go with this satirical kind of voiceover.
I've done movies, written movies for about 10 years now, and there's always a kind of likability problem with my heroines or my heroes. You know, the studios want people who are very, very likable, want characters that we can approve of in every single thing they do. So when I sat down to write this movie, I consciously wanted to write a character who wasn't necessarily immediately likable. And the voiceover is a very kind of assaultive or aggressive, can be annoying or irritating, provocative commentary. And that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to shake the audience up. Also, the character that Christina Ricci plays wreaks havoc in the character, the other characters' lives. And I also wanted the audience not to be safe from her. So occasionally in the movie, she kind of turns on the audience. And I think that's fun. We've had a good time doing it.
I felt a sense of relief as I listened to the voiceover because there's a certain kind of coming-of-age story, whether it's in fiction or in a movies, in the movie theater, that I'm so tired of. And when she says toward the end of that first voiceover that this isn't going to be the kind of movie that ends with her saying, "I was never the same again after that summer," I thought, phew, thank goodness.
I know, you know, you get tired very quickly of those type of self-conscious narrations, or when they show you a picture of a farm field in under snow and the voiceover is something like, "It was very snowy that winter." The kind of voiceover that adds nothing right. is really irritating to me.
Now, did you ever have to write that for somebody else, something you were commissioned to write?
I don't think I've ever written voiceover. You know, it's a law, kind of, out here in Hollywood, where they tell screenwriters, you know, avoid voiceover at all cost, avoid flashbacks at all cost, and avoid unlikable main characters at all cost. So I kind of
Strike
tried
three,
to...
Strike three, yeah.
Yeah. I did everything wrong.
Later on in the movie, as a result of Christina Ricci's misdeeds, her half-brother has been dumped by his boyfriend. And she says, in her voiceover narration, that people always look so sympathetic when they're getting dumped. And we see her half-brother looking around lonely and moping around. Mm-hmm. Then she says, "Wait, now I can really lay it on thick." Then the orchestra wells up in the background while the camera scans photographs, sentimental photographs of the guy together with his former lover. And I'm wondering if you've ever had to work in that style where you had to show, you know, you show the equivalent of, you know, the sentimental photographs and the orchestra swelling up in the background.
Usually a character is by a window and it's raining and they kind of trace a raindrop down the window pane.
Oh,
and
yes.
That kind of thing.
Yes, exactly.
I never had to write it. I love that. I mean, I'm a sucker and there's nothing better than a Lifetime Television for Women TV movie. And all of these tricks are in those movies. I wanted to have fun with it and see if we could still, if our narrator could kind of play with the form of the film and if the audience would still care about the characters. And, you know, audiences today are so sophisticated. You can play with the form. You can announce to the audience, hey, this is, we're all actors and this is just fun, and I can change the music and you can feel differently. And still, we will come back and care about the characters. We're very, very responsive to moving image. We've been trained and we go right back into it. So it was fun playing around with that. It really, you know, we're so conventional in Hollywood, and there are a list of conventions like that. When someone is sad, it's time for a montage. Or when people fall in love, it's time for a shopping montage, and the girl tries on a funny hat, and the guy feeds her, you know, frozen yogurt, and it misses her mouth. And, you know, boy, are we tired of that. So I wanted to have fun with it.
Don Roos is my guest, and he wrote and directed the film The Opposite of Sex. And the question is, of course, what is the opposite of sex?
I wish I had a good answer for that. And I'm really going to be much more careful the next time I choose a title. It's a natural question. And still now, after 6 months, I can't quite describe what I meant by it. I think part of it was was a play on words, because the movie is about some women and what women are like and what women can do. And that's the opposite sex, of course, in a very male-centrist world. So I wanted to play with that. It also made me laugh, the opposite of sex. What is that? What could that possibly be except, I guess, death or an Irish marriage? And then I thought maybe it's about characters who are in some way opposed to sex or find themselves in opposition to sex. And I think that's the truest explanation of the title. We kind of grow up thinking sex is a very natural part of our lives, and we would all say we were on good terms with sex, I think. Most of us would say that. It's part of our we want to think that anyway about ourselves. But many of us have a lot of trouble with sex and how it works in our lives. And these are a bunch of characters who haven't quite integrated sex in their lives in a way that makes them happy. The only one who does, I think, is Lyle Lovett's character, who has sort of found what sex means to him and is untroubled by it and very natural about it. He's the only character. He's got the smallest part, but he's got the wisest part, in a way, in the movie.
Lisa Kudrow plays a very interesting character, and she's a single woman who says that she just doesn't get sex. It's a lot of trouble for not much in return. And what kind of reflections about sex did you want to fit into her character, about her sense that sex is an inconvenience? You know, what's better about sex than somebody like blowing their nose in your face?
You wouldn't like that, would you? You know, that's a thought I've certainly had a lot of times. Boy, this is a lot of work for what? I mean, really, it really doesn't even last as long as a pizza. So why is my life about this so much? And I think it's a question we all have sooner or later. I think in our culture,
it's a question we even have about the pizza, which when it comes down to it, doesn't last that long either.
It's true. I think in our culture, we're like a sex-mad culture. And it's something that, well, look at Viagra. Look at the incredible, incredible amount of cultural commotion caused by this drug, which promises better sex. And we're obsessed with that. And I don't think we ask ourselves enough, why? Why? Is it natural, or is it some hyped-up connection to youth, or what is our obsession with sex about, besides, of course, it being a natural instinct and necessary for the species to continue? Why are we so interested?
There's two women in the movie who are basically trying to get gay men to become their lovers. The Lisa Kudrow character is trying to do that by trying to get this character to fall in love with her. But Christina Ricci is just trying to bully this other guy into having sex with her.
He's not very bright, so she has some compelling arguments why he should really have sex with her.
In fact, why don't we hear a scene from the movie in which he's trying to make her arguments to him.
He's like, what, 20 years older than you?
It's 9. Sometimes 10, depending on the month.
Have you always been a male?
Yeah, I guess.
You've never slept with a girl?
Nope. Never came up.
So to speak, right?
Well, it's just not for me.
How would you know if you've never tried it?
Well, I never tried communism, but I know I wouldn't like that. It's the same thing. Or grits.
Have you ever slept with a black person?
No. No, I don't think so.
Because you know you wouldn't like it.
No, I don't know that. I mean...
So, even though you've never tried either, you'd have sex with a black person, but not with me. God, it's like reverse discrimination. Quotas.
Is it?
Yeah, it's prejudice.
Don Roos, you're really having fun here with the whole idea of, you know, whether gay people can be converted to heterosexuality.
You know, I got into some trouble with some members of the gay press because there have been a few movies recently where a character's sexuality was maybe debatable. I mean, can we go back and forth? And I guess some people thought that the character that Ivan Sergei plays in this movie is converted to being straight and then is converted back to being gay, which isn't really what's happening in the movie. And he's a gay man in the movie, and everybody in the movie except himself accepts him as a gay man. And he does sleep with Christina Ricci's character, but it's not because he changes his orientation. It's because she is very wily and convincing, and he's no match for her. But he's always a gay man, and... I got into some trouble with the gay press for suggesting that people are pliable that way.
It's not easy to be a comic writer nowadays, is it?
Well, it's easy to be a comic writer. It's just not easy to escape censure from various groups and people that are your friends, really, who you usually agree with politically. Because comedy takes the view that everybody is funny and that would include, in my case, gay people are also very funny and very foolish and very troubled and very contradictory. And a lot of members of the gay press don't want to really look at that.
Well,
it's okay to make fun of straight people, of course, but not to make fun of gay people.
There are no characters in this movie who represent the establishment who get to be the bad guys. So all of these odd characters get to be the good guys and the bad guys.
Right.
So I think that's where you risk the political incorrectness in some people's eyes, because the bad guy lines aren't given to people who we recognize as the bad guys, the people
right.
who oppose homosexuality.
Right. And I found that to be true in my life. I mean, the bad guys in my life can be gay or straight, and they're not necessarily the kind of people we would recognize as authoritarian, official bad guys. You know, the people who cause me trouble are people like me. And so that's what I wanted to put in the movie.
Now the relationship that you've created between the Lisa Kudrow character and the Martin Donovan character, who's gay, is an interesting twist on the friendship between the straight woman and the gay man that so often exists in life and in some literature. But she really wants him to love her sexually, too, not just platonically.
You know, when I wrote the movie, that's what I had in mind. And then I sat down with Lisa Kudrow before she began, and she said, I don't see that. What I think she is about is family, is feeling loved by a man who loved her brother. And when her brother was alive, the three of them had a family, and that is what she's trying to get back to. So although I think it operates on a level of a female character wanting some kind of closeness, bond, relationship with a gay man, I don't think it's strictly now as sexual as it was when maybe I first sat down to write it. And it's an example of what actors bring to a role. Their take on characters is sometimes so much more interesting than my take on characters, a writer's take on characters. And if you're open, you can collaborate and get a better movie as a result. And I think that's true. I think what Lisa brought to that role was a kind of a refusal to be caricatured as a what we used to call a fag hag. I don't think they exist anymore. But a woman who requires the attention of gay men. It's a deeper role than that, and she does a better performance than she would have if she had tried to play that.
It was really interesting to see Lisa Kudrow in a role where she played someone who is very smart, also very neurotic and very repressed, very tense. Mm-hmm. But there was such intelligence there that you don't see in the television roles, because she's usually playing somebody not smart at all.
That's right.
What did you know about her or see in her that led you to realize that in spite of the roles that she's had before, she's very smart and plays very smart when it's appropriate?
I think I was being really conventional. And there is a convention that people who can do comedy can do drama. People who are really good comedians and comedians are very good dramatic actors. It doesn't work the other way around. You can be a wonderful dramatic actor and not be able to do comedy. But if you can do comedy, which is the hardest, you can do drama. And I think her other roles, while they immediately look as if they're dumb blondes, there's a lot more going on in those characters. I remember watching Romeo and Michelle and really, really being touched by the character that Lisa played, even though it was, you know, on the face of it, a stereotypical dumb blonde role. But, you know, if you think back on some of the dumb blondes in Hollywood, they're really the most accomplished actresses, effective and touching actresses, like Marilyn Monroe and Carol Lombard and Jean Arthur and Jean Harlow. They're very, very dumb is not easy to play, not easy to play convincingly. So I knew Lisa could do it.
My guest is Don Roos, the screenwriter and director of the film The Opposite of Sex. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Don Roos, he wrote and directed the new film The Opposite of Sex. He started his career writing for television. When you were writing for TV, you had to write things that would conform to the storyline and to the characters that were created by somebody else. But then it strikes me that The Opposite of Sex is the opposite of that, because this is really your show. You wrote it, you directed it. It's very eccentric and idiosyncratic. So, you know, you're obviously calling the shots on it. Was this the first movie that you felt that you could just create your own world?
Yes, because I didn't really expect anybody to make it. You know, when you write a movie, not just because of the gay content, not just because we had a gay character who wasn't in a dress and who wasn't sick with HIV or who wasn't battling discrimination. This was a gay character at the center of a movie, and the movie was not about him being gay. That was not the issue of the movie. He was just simply, that was who he was, and you had to accept him, and it wasn't extremely colorful that he was gay. He was just a gay lead. That was really hard to get an actor to do that. Actors are happy to play gay if they can hide behind a dress or a funny hat or an issue. And this was not that kind of role. That was hard. It was also an ensemble movie, which is really difficult to do in Hollywood. They find it hard to convey an ensemble movie to the audience, hard to market it. Besides The Big Chill, I think The Breakfast Club was a success, what you're saying is, I don't really know what this movie is about, but it's about interesting people, and once you get to know them, you will care about them. That's really hard to do in a billboard.
Now, your previous movies include Love Field, which is about two people traveling on the day of the, or shortly after the Kennedy assassination.
Mm-hmm.
Single White Female, which is about two roommates, one of which turns out to be a sociopath.
Mm-hmm.
And Boys on the Side, which was a comedy with Whoopi Goldberg and... who else?
Drew Barrymore and Mary Louise Parker. They did a wonderful job, those actresses.
So were you happy with the way the movies that you wrote but did not direct turn out, or were there aspects of those movies that were unrecognizable to you?
I don't say unrecognizable, but there were decisions made by directors, because they are the decision makers, that weren't my own. And so you are very frustrated. You've created this world, and yet you can't... you can't deliver it to the audience. It's very much like, you know, having a baby for 9 months, growing inside you, and then watching somebody else raise the child and have fun with it and decide where it goes to school. And there you are, you know, standing at the chain link fence looking into the playground. You know, that's how you feel as a writer about your
baby. Oh, I've seen
that
movie too.
And the music builds. And,
exactly.
They go to their car and cry. So it was frustrating only, not because I worked with some wonderful directors and they were very accommodating to me, but it's always their decision. You know, they are the ones who finally have the right to say yes or no. And that hurts if you have a writer's ego. You know, I sat down and wrote this before anybody was here, and I've made up this character, and you don't know what this scene is about, and I can't believe you did that. And of course, a writer is very hard on directors until he directs, and then you realize how difficult it is to bring a script to the screen, and how often things aren't in the movie for reasons that aren't about content, but just because I didn't have a matching close-up, or the close-up was, out of focus, or we were too busy that day and we couldn't give that scene that attention, or all sorts of really prosaic, boring reasons why the movie does not reflect the script.
Don Roos wrote and directed the comedy The Opposite of Sex. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Don Roos. He wrote and directed the film comedy The Opposite of Sex. He also wrote the screenplays for Love Field, Single White Female, and Boys on the Side. Now, you started off writing for television, I think in the late 70s. What'd you write for?
I wrote for Heart to Heart, which, you remember Heart to Heart, they had probably the shortest Christmas card list by the end of that show's run, because all of their friends were murdered or involved in murders or imprisoned, and they weren't really detectives. They were just a very rich couple whose friends kept disappearing. So I wrote for that for 4 years and loved that show. That was a great, great introduction into writing for film. You write the show one day, you film it the next day, you look at it in the dailies the following day, and you edit it, and it's just a great education in what happens, how you translate the page to the screen. So I was very, very lucky to get on that show.
And you wrote for Dynasty 2?
Yes, Dynasty 2, the Colbys, and a lot of really kind of, I wouldn't say they were quality television shows, except that they were very popular, and they weren't necessarily deep shows, but they were a great deal of fun and made with people who were really talented, and it was a great working environment. Aaron Spelling ran a very gay-friendly, female-friendly kind of world at that time. I'm sure he still does. He had a lot of women in non-traditional women roles at that time in the industry, directors and unit production managers and assistant directors, and he was very, very left-wing in that respect. And many, many gay people worked for him as well. So he ran a great studio.
Now, what were some of the conventions you had to follow on Dynasty 2?
Dynasty 2. Well, nobody could really behave in a healthy emotional way. That was number one. Everybody had to be outraged at how people were treating them. They had to really go with their worst instincts, usually. If you thought of a scene, you had to kind of ratchet it up and have people take offense where no offense was intended, be suspicious when no conspiracy was planned. Just in general, rich people behaving badly was a general convention. And also, you had to hurt your characters, and it was fun to write that. You had to, how can I hurt Crystal the most? How can I hurt Fallon the most? What's the most wounding thing that can be said to this character in the course of this scene? Because that's the big close-up at the end, you know, of the scene, which they always ended in a big close-up of the main character being slapped in the face verbally or mentally or emotionally being assaulted by some really horrible thing.
And that would be the equivalent of the cliffhanger.
That's right.
How will Crystal react to that slight?
Mm-hmm, exactly. And how much can we make them suffer? And that was great fun, actually. You got rid of a lot of hostility that way. Your characters.
Why else do you think that audiences enjoyed so much watching these characters suffer?
I think we all suffer in various ways in our lives, and it's nice to see glamorous people suffer more. I just think it makes us feel better, makes us feel less alone. It's like, oh, okay, well, I didn't get that promotion, but Crystal is being, you know, assaulted, and that makes me feel better. It certainly made us feel better on the show. I mean, our lives were cake compared to what we were making our characters go through.
Were there any stereotypes you had to uphold?
Yes. First of all, the idea that that family, this weird idea that family, that your name, that your family meant something real. It was always, well, I'm a Colby, and Colbys do this, or I'm a Carrington, and Carrington do. Now, in my real life, my parents don't go around saying, well, we're Rooses, and Rooses behave this certain way. It was weird. They were all like Kennedys, you know, the family dynamic. So I think that was ridiculous. That was one convention. I think the women, the convention for the women were to be devious, either devious or sweet. And that was the typical Madonna whore kind of convention that we have here in America, where women are villains or they are sweet wives and mothers, and there's nothing in between. And the men are strong and silent and tough and steady and very, very conventional comic book ideas about how men and women behave to each other.
And did you ever feel bad that you were continuing these stereotypes that you didn't believe in?
You know what? I didn't. I think I was so happy to be working in the business and so happy to be making any kind of money. I was just delighted to be there. I did feel guilty later for a show I was on called Nightingales. Do you know about that show?
Was that Nurses or something?
Yeah, yeah. It was the worst version of Nurses, the stereotypical nurses in a bra and panties kind of...
Roger Corman kind of nurses.
Exactly. And we thought, you know, we all had great, good intentions, all of us working on that show. We wrote these wonderful scripts, and then Aaron said, we had been working a while before the show came on the air, and Aaron said, well, I want you to come down now because we built all of the sets that are going to be for the show. So come on down and look at them. So we all marched down there thinking we were doing a show about the front line of medical care in America and the virtue of nurses and all of this high-minded stuff. And he showed us the sets, which were the student nurse's locker room, the student nurse's aerobic studio, the student nurse's changing room, whatever that would be, the student nurse's bathroom. It was unbelievable. There wasn't an operating room. There wasn't a patient room. So we very quickly knew the kind of show we were writing. It was very disappointing.
And you had to write appropriate plots, no doubt.
No, you know what we did have to do, you know, nurses in linen closets falling in love with young doctors. But we still maintained a very high-minded approach to the scripts. And I, as a gay man, I didn't notice whether a woman was in a bra or a merry widow or whatever. We would write these scenes that were very earnest. And then they would shoot them. We would see them in dailies. And in the background, they're, you know, in the foreground, the nurse is saying, my father is an alcoholic, and I'm having trouble dealing with that. In the background, there'd be girls struggling into corsets and brassieres. Of course, didn't bother me. It was nothing I was watching. So I was all about how wonderful the shows were. And then the nurses wrote in, real nurses wrote in. And all of the writers took that off our resumes after that show.
Oh, that's funny.
And, of course, when we ever went to a hospital, we would never mention that we'd worked on Nightingales.
Don Roos is my guest, and he wrote and directed the new film, The Opposite of Sex. Do you know what your next movie will be?
I wrote a picture last year called Bounce, which is about a love affair that occurs after a plane crash. And I'm going to be directing that for Propaganda in the fall.
Is that a comedy?
It's funny. I don't know if it's a comedy. It's more of a love story with comedic interruptions. You know, it's a more a conventional kind of story. It's a love story between people who really should not have met. But I think it's a wonderful story. I happen to really like it, and it'll be fun to do a movie which isn't as showy as The Opposite of Sex, where we called a lot of attention to the filmmaking and the movie making in that picture. And this will be different. We'll be playing it straight in this movie, so that'll be interesting.
Well, not completely straight, I'd imagine.
No, not. I can't do that. I won't do that, but fairly straight.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
It was a pleasure, Terry. I appreciate the opportunity.
Don Roos wrote and directed the new comedy, The Opposite of Sex.